I'm Josh Zolin, host of the Blue is the New White podcast, and I've got grit.
Welcome to another episode of Grit Northwest. I'm Joe Cadwell, writer, producer, and host of the show. Today I interview the CEO of Windy City Equipment Service, former Hollywood stuntman, podcast host, and author of Blue is the New White, The Best Path to Success No One Told You About Until Now, Josh Zolin. Last month on the show, I aired a two-part series where I was the guest on Josh's podcast, Blue is the New White. Now the microphones are turned and Josh will be sharing with us the lessons he learned on how to find success working in the trades. We'll start today's conversation by learning why Josh walked away from an exciting career as a professional stuntman to help his father build and grow a successful multi-state equipment service company with over 50 employees. Next, we'll look into what inspired Josh to write his book and why he feels the notion that having a college degree is the only path to an economic success, security, and happiness is an oversold illusion. Josh will later tell us what attributes and skills he feels are necessary to be competitive in the trades, and we'll end our conversation when we find out how Josh defines success as a blue-collar worker. After the show, be sure to check out the episode notes to find out more about Josh, his book, and his podcast. And now, on to the show. Josh Zolin, welcome to the show.
Joe, thanks so much for having me on. I'm excited about our conversation today.
Yeah, so am I. Thank you so much, Josh, for taking your time to be on the show. I really enjoyed being on your podcast, which I think my listeners got to hear not too long ago, The Blue is the New White. It was a two-part interview that you did on me, so I'm happy now to turn around and get to talk to you and introduce you to the listeners. So, Josh, I understand that you're calling in from Arizona right now, and that you are the CEO of Windy City Equipment Services. And how did you become the CEO of Windy City Services?
Oh boy, you want the long version or the short version?
Well, I'll be honest, let's take the short version because I know saw a fun little fact about you being a stuntman back in your younger days, and I really want to focus on that. But yeah, nutshell, how did you get to be the CEO of Windy City Equipment Services?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I'm going to do is I'll pick up after the stuntman thing, and then we'll dive deeper into that later. So after I decided I didn't want to be a stuntman anymore, I had moved out to Arizona because my dad had started a small company out here called Windy City Equipment. It was just him running service out of the back of a truck, specializing in hot side restaurant equipment repair, ovens, fryers, stoves, that kind of thing. And so when I decided I didn't want to be in Hollywood anymore, I called him up and I said, Dad, I've got no idea what you do for a living, but I want to be a part of the business. I want to grow it, you know, and I want to work alongside you. And so that was back in 2007, 2008. And, you know, my dad's a super old school guy, right? So I got out to Arizona. I was still young at that point. I think I was 21 or 22. And, he said, you know, if you want to be a part of this business, you got to learn from the ground up, learn how to actually be a technician, turn wrenches, all that. No free rides here, you know, which I always respect and appreciate. So, you know, I basically, you know, worked in the field learning the trade for 7-8 years. And then I started to understand a little bit more about the back end, how that worked with, you know, dispatching and invoicing and quotes and all of that. And I didn't really know what I was doing at the time. I read a lot of books, talked to a lot of people, didn't have a podcast back then, but I still loved to talk to people, especially, you know, if they know more in a certain area than I do that I'm interested in. I just, you know, love a good conversation. So through the years, you know, it was a slow growth at first. We brought on one employee, two employees, three employees, still working out of my dad's garage. And then in 2014, I believe it was 2014, we got a commercial building. I finally got all that equipment out of his garage and out of his side yard, and HOA was starting to get pretty pissed off at him. But you know, after that, it felt a little bit more real. And I think I was VP of the company at that time. And in 2015, I took over as CEO. We opened an HVAC and refrigeration division. expanded out into Tucson. And then over the next few years, bought another commercial building because we quickly outgrew the first one that we bought, and opened up branches in Houston, Texas, and Albuquerque, New Mexico. And today we have 50 employees, something like that, across three states and four branches.
The business of HVAC is obviously very needed in the Southwest, I'm sure. Now, I, as you were telling your story, you had mentioned that you wanted to leave Hollywood. That just wasn't meeting your needs. And the story that I had heard was you, your family was in the stunt business for a long period of time. So what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so that was the family business. My grandfather started it. You know, he was an old school stuntman, one of the first stuntmen to be called stuntmen, if you will, you know, from the rodeo days and stuff like that. He doubled for Charles Bronson and Elvis Presley. And I mean, he's done so many films. I can't even count. For the older audience, if you remember the Banana Splits Hour, Danger Island, my grandfather was Chango.
No way. I used to love that show as a kid.
Oh, Chango.
Oh, man, that's crazy.
Yeah, so that's my grandfather. And so he had four kids, my mom being one of them. And obviously she and all of my uncles were also in the stunt business. So that's what I grew up doing. That's what I grew up knowing. That's what set me apart. And my dad, actually, before he had started Windy City Equipment, he was a stuntman as well. That's how he and my mom met. So all through high school, I grew up knowing exactly what I was going to do the rest of my life. And that was, I was going to be a stuntman. You know, at the time, I think I confused being cool for what I wanted to do the rest of my life, because, you know, being a stuntman was pretty cool to say, right? I was very vocal in high school about not wanting to go to college. I knew what I was going to do. I didn't need any of that. You know, I was going to go be a stuntman, and that's exactly what I did. So did what I thought I loved for a couple of years, and really started to understand the other side of it, right? The jumping off the buildings, lighting yourself on fire, rolling the cars. That was all fun, and it was unique, and it was different, and, you know, gave me kind of an identity. But the back end of Hollywood, the who you know, the bureaucracy, you know, everything else that I encountered while I was there just kind of shed a new light for me. And I realized that wasn't what I wanted to do the rest of my life. So, you know, at that point, I just packed it all up, and I had always had an entrepreneurial spirit. You know, that's one thing that set me apart as a kid as well, in addition to the stunt stuff. But I was always that kid, you know, doing all the fundraisers, starting my own small businesses, you know, just trying to do odd jobs for people. Hey, you got that pile of rocks? Why don't I move that pile of rocks 5 feet to the left? Would that help you? You know? And, I gave it all up and got into the trades.
So that's fascinating, Josh. The life of a stuntman, huge amount of physicality, a huge amount of mental toughness, and a sense of daring for sure. What would you say probably the toughest stunt you ever had to do was?
Well, there's a couple of them that come to mind. Jumping off of a 5-story building is never easy. Okay, you know, you've got a big airbag at the bottom, right? And this airbag is huge. I mean, once it's full of air, it stands, you know, 8 feet high. It's, you know, 20 feet long, 10 feet wide. It's a big pillow, right? But when you're 5 stories up, that pillow looks like a dime. You know what I'm saying? And you're aiming for the center of it. So every time I did one of those falls, it was a little nerve-wracking, to say the least. But the hardest stunt I ever did, and I've talked about this one before, but I did a commercial for Alltel Wireless. For those of you that remember Alltel Wireless out there, I doubled the AT&T guy. His name was Scott. And there was a commercial that he did, and he kind of was on a football field on the sidelines, and, you know, everything was all about Alltel. So he was the AT&T guy, and he kind of stepped out and said, oh man, how can this day get any worse? And then right then and there, he gets pummeled by a football player running full speed and full gear. And, you know, spoiler alert, that was not Scott. That was me getting hit. And, you know, the kicker, what made that so difficult was, you know, it doesn't sound as daunting as jumping off of a five-story building, right? It's just getting hit by a football player. But I had to do that 15 times in a row. And this guy was in full football gear. I had no pads on. I was there because I knew how to fall, right? I was the guy that knew how to get hit. Well, that knowledge only takes you so far. You still have to get hit. And so we did 15 takes of that. And man, I mean, I was battered and bruised. And, you know, the next day was super difficult. But the tipping point was when I saw the commercial air and realized that they used the very first take that we did. And at that point, I was like, this can't be the rest of my life. This cannot be the rest of my life.
It does sound like a tough way to make a living. Along the way, you've developed a lot of skills. One of them must have been the ability to put pen to paper, because you are the author of a book which came out less than 2 years ago called Blue is the New White. How did you come to writing that book?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think it's fair to point out that I've never been a huge reader of books. I mean, as of late, I am, obviously. I've got a bookshelf full of books. I developed a passion for reading later in life. But in high school, you couldn't pay me to read a book. You know, I was a Spark Notes kind of guy. Even though I only had dial-up internet at the time, I'd still try to Google what the plot line was of any homework assignment that I had. But you know, as I was going through my journey with Windy City Equipment and I was learning the industry and I was looking for any and all potential resources that I could accumulate more knowledge, the first indicator for me was that there was nothing out there really on the trades. Not anywhere near the trade that I was in. There still isn't. You know, but the trades in general, there just wasn't a ton of information, which blew my mind because, you know, of how long the trades date back and everything else. There just wasn't any modern information of what it all meant and the opportunities that were in it. Once we started building the business and I started bringing on employees and I started understanding and realizing the value of technicians and how smart they were and what kind of money they made and what kind of benefits they had, you know, because they were all coming from competitors and stuff like that. And so I got to know the market, know the industry. And it was mind-boggling to me that so much success could be achieved in this and other industries within the skilled trades, but no one knew about it. You know, nobody ever talked about it. Nobody told me about it, you know. And as I looked more and more, it just became more and more evident that this perception had developed around the skilled trades that it was menial, low level, can't cut it in college kind of work. And so I thought something needed to be done about that. And I kept saying, you know, somebody should write a book. Somebody should write a book. And, you know, at the same time, my wife kept hearing me say, you know, one day I'd like to write a book. One day I'd like to write a book. So finally, she was just like, shut up and write a book. And I said, oh, all right. Yeah. Why don't I do that? So I did.
And how difficult of a process was that?
It was, you know, it was tough at first because I tried to do it all by myself. I had only been reading books for the last, you know, at that point for the last 6 years, 7 years or so. And so it was tough. I didn't know where to start. I had note cards, I had index cards, I had a Word document, I had a paper notebook, I had all these different things with all these different notes and chapters and topics and all this. And I had no idea how to put it all together. So I went online and I found a publisher that aided in the process. So I was able to kind of give them all my notes and tell them what I hadn't written down. And then they organized it into something a little bit more legible. You know what I'm saying? And so once that took shape, then the rest was pretty was, I don't want to say easy, but, you know, it made it a whole lot easier to get accomplished at that point.
Sure. And your book now is available for purchase on Amazon.com, I noticed.
Yep. We got paperback, hardcover, audiobook, and Kindle editions.
And the full name of the book is Blue is the New White.
The Best Path to Success That Nobody Told You About Until Now.
Great title. How did you come up with that working title? Was that the working title or the finished title?
That was the finished title. The working title was just, I don't remember what the working title was. I think it was like Benefits of the Skilled Trades or something like that, you know. But that process too was another one that my wife helped me with. You know, we must have written out 75, 85 different titles and just kind of gone down the list and wanted something that was captivating, that you know, got people's attention, but wasn't too, you know, mundane. You know, if you write a book that says, this is why you should get into the skilled trades. Look, we all say don't judge a book by its cover, right? But why do books have covers? So it was one of those things, but that's kind of how we came up with it. And then the subtitle, The Best Path to Success That Nobody Told You About Until Now, became obvious when we started to talk more about the perceptions in the book. And really the whole premise is that this isn't talked about enough. So the book itself is geared toward like high school level with enough data and information inside of it to gain the respect of educators and parents and things like that. So it was kind of like a two-sided demographic there.
Sure. And Blue of the New White obviously alludes to blue collar is the new white collar, which conversely, white collar was the new blue collar back at some period of time.
That's right.
So things have kind of come full circle for the longest period of time in American history and basically just the structure of work. We've had blue collar jobs. That's what built nations around the world. And then there became a period of time where the infrastructure was built, and now we could do other things that required possibly degrees that, you know, outside of the trade. And that's when colleges really became more in vogue and more popular, and everyone was encouraged to go to college. And as you know, so many of the trades-oriented programs in high schools, the wood shops, the metal shops, the auto shops, those things just fell by the wayside as the students were being pushed towards academia. And we're beginning to find that now these college degrees are oftentimes easily outsourced to third world countries where people are doing the same work for a fraction of the cost. So it comes back to having these blue collar hands-on jobs that are really going to be the foundation for a strong economy, especially here in the US and Canada.
Absolutely. I mean, without a doubt, I couldn't have said it better myself. You know, and one of the things I like to say is, you know, the blue collar trades are what manufacture civilization as we know it, as we see it today, you know. And that's one thing that I'll say, you know, once I got into the trades and I developed this almost, I don't want to say like my eyes were opened, you know, I would look out the truck when I was running service and look out the window. And I'd see everything around me. You know, I was in Phoenix running around and fixing equipment at different restaurants all day, every day. And I saw the world in a whole new light, right? I looked out the window. I saw the pavement for the streets, the paint on the streets. I saw the street lights. I saw the buildings. I saw, you know, all the dump trucks going back and forth up and down the highways and the tow trucks and, you know, everything else and the cranes that were building buildings. And, you know, I started to kind of really understand at that point what the blue collar world actually was and what it meant. And then, you know, as time went on, I could put a dollar sign to every single one of those things that I saw, you know, and it's just amazing. I think more people need to recognize, you know, the value of each trade and what it can do for civilization, for society. And you're absolutely right. You know, it's like we focused heavily on the trades. And then, like you said, once the infrastructure was built, you know, it kind of swung the opposite direction and focused more on academia. and we weren't able to strike a healthy balance between the two. It became an either or. And it just, you know, that part of it is really frustrating to me because, you know, I have nothing against academia. I'm a lifelong learner myself. I love to learn, you know, but it became the idea of, well, if you want to be successful, that's the route you have to go. And I mean, that's what I was told. And, you know, I know so many people that were told the exact same thing. You know, I did a podcast earlier last year with a guy that said his counselor told him that he was too smart to be a plumber, you know? And I mean, when you listen to rhetoric like that, it's, you know, it creates an illusion of what's necessary for success and, you know, what your goals are in life, you know, and that can be super confusing for somebody who's 18 years old, 16 years old.
That's for sure. And this belief that, career in the trades, these aren't first choice careers, that these are people that couldn't cut it in by going to university, by going to college, is a complete fallacy. And you'll often find people with PhDs who serve a mean cup of coffee at Starbucks to those plumbers, those electricians, carpenters, and craftspeople. So the return on investment doesn't seem to always pay off well for people that do choose. And again, not to speak disparagingly against those people that do want to go to college and are able to do so. But again, when you're 16, 17, 18, you're in high school, you're not really sure which direction you want to go. I myself chose the military. I felt that was a great option for me. And I really appreciated that opportunity. But for a lot of other folks who may not want to do that, the trades can, the apprenticeship programs can provide at least an avenue to get yourself sort of straightened out, start earning some livable wages right out the get-go, and kind of figure out which direction you want to go.
No, absolutely. I mean, and the life skills that you accumulate, you know, through your journey in the trades is unbelievable as well. You know, I like what you said, you know, with the return on investment for college, because that's really what it all boils down to, right? Is that everybody defines their success differently. Everybody has an idea of what they want in life. And if college is going to get you to that place, whether it be for the money or for the peace of mind or for the time or whatever it may be, then fine. You know, and if what you want to do requires a college education, go to college, you know, and if that's the thing that you want to do, and college, as we all know, is incredibly expensive, find a way to pay for it. Work three jobs, get scholarships, you know, do well in high school, all of that. And you know, so it all boils back to the ROI. What can college do for you? The problem is that, I don't know, 80% of students, I'd say, and this isn't, I'm just pulling numbers out of the air, so don't quote me on this, but like, I'd say that 80% of the kids that I went to school with and that I graduated with had no idea what they wanted to do the rest of their life. So they were told to go to college in order to figure it out, which is just terrible advice, because now you're paying to go to school, right? And you're digging yourself this hole of debt because you didn't know what you wanted to do. So chances are you didn't do that well in high school. You didn't really care about it, you know, I mean, maybe a little bit, but you didn't try as hard as you probably should have or whatever. So you're not getting a scholarship is my point. You know, and at that point, it's like, you know, you're just paying to get more schooling and not know what direction you're headed until you finally pick something off that piece of paper that they lay in front of you that you want to do for the next 50 years, you know, and that's just, that's a dangerous brew, if you ask me.
For sure. And so aside from the book, you've also started in the last few years, a podcast, also going by the name Blue is the New White podcast, where you, much like my show, interview folks who have started businesses, who are currently in the trades. And what can you tell us about the people that you interview?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was a spinoff of the book, you know, kind of it went hand in hand. And after I wrote the book, I had a different podcast. It was called the Perception Evolution Project. And that was more geared toward service business and the perception of what service is. And that kind of evolved once the book came out, because people kept saying, hey, you know, you should do more on careers and in the skilled trades. And so I started talking to successful and happy people that were tradespeople or trades adjacent or advocates of the trades. And I mean, that just, that took on a life of its own. As you know, I mean, you were on the show and we were talking before the show, one of the most listened to episodes, because the thing is that, you know, again, even with my book in circulation, there's still not a ton of information out there about the skilled trades. There's becoming more and more, right, with the social media and everything else that's going on today, that being able to share information is easier than ever. But you know, a lot of it is kind of the face value stuff, right? It's how much money can you make in the trades? What trades actually exist? Where can you go to learn a trade? But seldom do you hear from people within a trade that tell you why they're happy and tell you why they love what they do. And that's what Blue is the New White is all about, is, you know, finding your definition of success, living it, and then, you know, my show provides a platform to share that with others.
And I'd have to agree. We don't have a whole lot of high-level personalities or advocates promoting the trades. I can think right off the top of my head, Mike Rao, Dirty Jobs, would probably be the rock star of our public side of things. There's a fellow named Ken Rusk who wrote a book called Blue Collar Cash, The Million Dollar... Yep. Ditch Digger. I think he's another like great success story. And then you just have a lot of people that are just happily making a solid living, providing for their families, putting money away for retirement, and doing what they love. And that's, I think, really, really important. So in my particular situation as an apprentice coordinator at the Pacific Northwest Carpenters Institute in Portland, Oregon, which is a regional training center for the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America, I am just so happy to see young people coming in and saying, yes, this is the career path that I want to go. And and taking, again, I think I used the phrase in on your show, they're you know, using their hands, putting their head into the game, and most importantly, putting their heart into their craft and really making a strong go at it. And again, not taking away anything from folks who do go to college to be the doctors and the lawyers and their jobs, but they do need hospitals in which to perform these operations, and courthouses need to be built in order to have those trials. So the book, the podcast, where you're at now as CEO of Windy City Equipment, have a lot to, you have a lot to offer, I'm sure, in regards to what it means to be successful. What traits or what attributes do you think that you have gathered to hold you accountable to be so successful? Where do you attribute that?
Oh man, you know, I learned a lot. Look, when I was in Hollywood, I kind of alluded to this before, but when I was in Hollywood, my ego kind of ran my life, right? I was the stunt man. I was the cool guy. I was the guy that lit himself on fire. You don't know anybody else that can do that. And so the first lesson I think that I learned from that was humility. I got in my own way a lot, I think, because I thought I was something that I wasn't. And so when I made that decision to change what I thought I was going to do the rest of my life, I had to kind of take myself down a peg, you know, and it was humbling. I had to admit that what I told everybody that I loved and what I told everybody that I was good at and what I was actually good at just wasn't what I actually wanted. So humility was incredibly important. That first lesson was vital in me figuring out my success. And thank goodness, I mean, I figured it out when I did. You know, I was 21, 22 years old. Some people don't figure that out until they're 30, 40, 50 years old. And, you know, a lot of times that's what I'm talking about with the college education, is that, you know, you pick something off of a paper and because it sounds interesting, and then you're stuck doing that the rest of your life. Suddenly you wake up at 45 years old and realize that's not really what you wanted. The longer you go through life, the harder it is to start over, right? So humility was the first lesson. And then, you know, once I got into the trade, I mentioned my dad was old school, right? Hard work was that second lesson. I mean, and there's no skating it, right? There's hard work is important no matter what you do, no matter what industry you're in, whether you're in Hollywood, in college, in the trades, doesn't matter. Hard work is like the number one thing that's going to get you to where you want to go. And I thought I was a hard worker. You know, I'd be hustling sets at 3 o'clock in the morning and stuff like that in Hollywood, trying to get gigs and stuff. But I mean, I was a night owl. I was up anyway. You know what I mean? It sounds good when I say, hey, I was on a set at 3 o'clock in the morning, but you know, I didn't tell you that it was on the way home from the bar. You know what I mean? So, hard work is definitely important. When I started working with my dad, I'd get up at, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, work with him. And again, I started at the bottom. So I was making very little money, you know, while I was learning. I was still making money, but I was not making a ton of it. So I'd work with him until about 5 or 6 at night. And then I would go deliver pizzas, on the side from about 7 o'clock at night to 11 o'clock at night and come home and do it all over again the next day. But, you know, what that taught me is how much you can get accomplished in a 24-hour period or, you know, an 18-hour period because you got to sleep sometime. But, you know, that was definitely one of the things that paved the way. And I have my dad and the trade to thank for that. And then, you know, accountability is huge. And we talked about it when you were on the show a little bit about how accountability is almost natural in this line of work because you're responsible for a task. You have to complete that task. And if you don't complete that task, there's nobody to blame but you. You know, so that was important, you know, being able to figure out and to realize that once you take ownership of everything around you, everything in your life, every decision that you make, and recognize that there's no one else to blame, nothing else to blame, you know, it really helps you turn a corner, I think, because it brings to light what you can influence if you just take a step back and stop blaming it on somebody else or something else, you know. And so those three things, I think, were huge. Humility, hard work, and accountability.
I'd like to add two more things. One, I actually heard you being interviewed on another person's podcast, and the story goes a little bit beyond you finishing up the evening delivering pizza. In this podcast, you said that you would get home from the pizza delivery, mm-hmm. and then you would start taking apart some of the pieces that you would replace during the day when you were working with your dad to figure out how they worked. And I think a curious mind is something that you possess, and a lot of people that are successful, they want to keep learning. They want to figure out what makes things work. And I was really impressed by that. And you talked about your dogs licking the grease off of the parts as you had them laid out on the living room floor. So I'm going to say that's an important one as well. And then you just mentioned as well, Josh, about being able to, you know, influence or the influence. And I think that is a huge part when you begin to, you know, really become comfortable in your skin and really know what you are capable of, then you can really take those skills and start turning them into something that can help others and being a mentor. And as folks who do podcasts, we obviously like to talk, we like to communicate. What are some of the strengths you think of being an effective leader are in regards to communication and running crews?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And, you know, that's admittedly one of the skills I'm trying to hone in on here in 2021. You know, I've had obviously success with it in the past, running a team of, you know, 50 plus employees and stuff like that. I like to think myself as a good communicator, as a good leader. Again, I said before, I'm a lifelong learner, right? And I've got this, if you ask my wife, she'll call it an insatiability, right? I never feel satisfied with where I am. I always think that there's room for improvement, and leadership and communication are two of the ones that I want to focus on a lot, because I think there's so much value in both of those, and they go hand in hand. So, you know, I think best thing that I can say about leadership and communicating really is two things, right? There's motivation and there's inspiration. Motivation lasts a day, a week, a month. Inspiration lasts a lifetime. I want to be able to inspire. That's how I want to lead. And the only way to do that, you can motivate by telling somebody, but you can inspire by asking somebody. And what I mean by that is that to really change somebody's outlook or to help them grow as a person, you have to ask questions. You have to let them come to their own conclusions rather than tell them, you know, what it is that they need to conclude. So I think that's the number one in leadership is being able to ask questions and being able to ask the right questions and gently nudge somebody in the direction of figuring out the problem at hand, right? Because typically as a leader, people are coming to you with problems. People are coming to you with issues. The people are coming to you because they want advice. And the popular thing to do and the thing that we all want to do is give that advice and solve the problem and be the hero. But the right way to do it from a leadership standpoint is to help that person solve the problem or help that person give their own advice, you know, and come to their own conclusions. So I'd say, you know, asking questions, asking the right questions is imperative to leadership and communication.
Inspire that learning mentality in the people that you're meeting is super important. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Simon Sinek video where he talks about golden circles. And it's not so much to tell people what we do or how we do it, but actually get them to understand why we do things. And if you can get them to adopt that philosophy, you'll find that you are creating people that truly are problem solvers and then can think critically as well. So you have asked every one of your guests on your show this question, and I'm going to steal a page out of your book now. Josh Solon, what is your definition of success?
Oh, boy. I knew you were going to use that. No. I love this because, you know, it seems like I don't get asked this question a lot. Obviously, you know that I ask this question a lot, but I don't get asked this question a lot every once in a while. And every time I feel like there's one more thing that I add, and it's because that I think it's because our definition of success changes so often as we grow up, as we get older, as we learn more. Today, this very moment, my definition of success is first and foremost, this will always be my first answer, is being able to lay my head on the pillow at night, knowing that I accomplished something that day. I have to feel accomplished in some way, shape, or form, like I took a step forward. Otherwise, I won't be able to sleep until I do, which means I'm breaking out the laptop and I'm learning something or I'm doing something. But that's first and foremost. Second is being able to provide a good life for my family. You know, of course, my definition, like so many others out there, my definition of success changed as soon as I had kids. I live to keep them safe now and make sure that they have a good upbringing and that they can be problem solvers and leaders themselves. And then the other thing I think, like we talked about before, is being able to inspire others. Something that is ever elusive. And, you know, I think there's a lot of people out there that pride themselves on being able to motivate others, and especially in the world of social media, right? There's so many people out there that, you know, can post memes and quotes and, you know, have a ton of followers because they spill all this good advice. But I like that personal touch, right? I'm not a huge social media guy, even though I have the podcast and stuff like that. That's a struggle for me because that person isn't in front of me. I want to be able to take people, look them in the eye, and help them develop themselves and help them grow and, you know, really just inspire them to live whatever their definition of success is and help those around them. I think that's the most organic way to inspire people.
Josh Zolan, this has been a fantastic conversation. Where can our listeners go to find out more about you and your book?
Yeah, absolutely. So blueisthenewwhite.com is the easiest way. There's links on there to the podcast and to the Amazon page where you can purchase a copy of the book. Also, should be links to YouTube. We have video of almost all of our podcasts. And then if you want to find me on social media, LinkedIn is my main platform, but you can find me at Josh Zolan everywhere else.
All right. Thank you again, Josh, for taking your time to be on the show.
Thank you. You too, Joe.
Well, that wraps up this edition of Grit Northwest. If you liked today's show, be sure to hit the subscribe button so you won't miss an episode. Grit Northwest is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. We're also available on the web at buildnw.org/podcast. For up-to-the-minute content, follow Grit Northwest on Twitter. Interested in hearing more programs like this? If so, visit laborradionetwork.org. There you'll find over 80 union and labor-specific shows designed to educate and empower you to take charge of your future. As always, thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to share the show with anyone you think may benefit from it. And until next time, this is Joe Cadwell reminding you to work safe, work smart, and stay union strong.